Walt Kovalik, and I'm the Acting Deputy Regional Administrator for Region 5 here in Chicago. And you're in the room here for, and on the phone and on the web for our EPA University Entrepreneur Roundtable. I'm going to spend some time this morning talking about several different subjects, and we're delighted to have several presenters who are going to be on the phone, and everybody's going to be watching the same screen that we're watching here in Chicago. For those of you on the phone, we're sitting in a room with about 75 seats in it, about 40 people here who are seating training style at tables. And I'm not going to go around the room and around the phone, or we'd be here an extra half hour, so forgive that lack of protocol, but we are take questions in the room.
Anthony?
And repeat them.
Anthony? Sit right there.
Those of you on the phone need to mute your phones, except when you're asking questions. And we'll keep the questions here in the room. The people in the room will hear your questions over the speakers as we do that. My plan is to go through the quickly as we can through the presentations, and then we'll take questions, and I'll alert those of you on the phone that I'm going to pick some states or some other ways for you to think in advance so you can be ready to talk, and we'll then come back to the room for questions as well. So to repeat the purpose of this meeting, for those of you that are a while ago, we have had a set of advisory committee recommendations at EPA from a national advisory committee on environmental policy and technology, which suggested that EPA should figure out ways to get more engaged with both the investor community, that is angel investors and venture capitalists, and as it turns out, with those who have the ideas to be developed, which is the reason for this meeting. So we did have a meeting with those investors on September 24th, virtually identical to this meeting, a smaller group around the table talking about the two things that we're presenting today that we hope to get your feedback on. They're towards the latter part of the agenda, but I'll just tee that up again for you. First of all, we're trying to get feedback on whether articulating sets of problems like this brochure you have here in the room and the one that you have emailed to you if you were on the web, both from ourselves, our Region 6 office, and the General Services Administration, is a way to give you ideas for what the needs are out there that we see. And the second part of the feedback we're seeking feedback on is whether or not our regulatory agenda can be fodder for ideas for future development. For those of you who are insomniacs, twice a year we publish 150 pages called the Semiannual Regulatory Agenda, and it lists all the regulations that we're planning to issue over the next 2 to 3 years. What you got in the mail, email, or we'll be talking about a little bit later, is a digest of those where we try to collapse down to at least 14 or 15 examples of regulations that we think might cause the need for a new technology to be developed. For example, for changing the particulate level for that we're regulating for lead, that might be a new opportunity for both monitoring and measurement or for treatment technologies. So later on in the meeting, we're also going to be seeking feedback on that concept. In general, we're not talking about a technology today, so you'll forgive me if we get off in our comments talking about a specific technology. If we can, we'll probably truncate that discussion for offline. There are EPA people in the building. They're listed in the flyer who have specific interests, and their phone number and email are there. We're really trying to get feedback on whether or not producing this kind of document or how to produce it on the web or otherwise makes sense as providing leads for universities, entrepreneurs, engineers, and others, and also the same thing, whether or not it makes sense to do the regulatory digest and so forth.
Walt, this is Jean. I'm sorry to interrupt, but your volume's coming through very quietly. Is there any way you can increase it or get closer to the phone?
I'm on my mic, but I would help if I had the mic on, wouldn't it? I've got two mics here.
That's better. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jean. So what we're going to be doing this morning is just to look at the agenda that you have there. I'm going to spend about 13 slides. I'm going to go fast, a mile a minute, talking about our her self-perception on how EPA is involved in technologies and technology development. We're not the Department of Energy. We're not the National Science Foundation. We're not the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. So I want to make sure that your view and understanding of what we think we do in technology is compares, and we'll take some questions after that. That's the first part under EPA's fostering a role in fostering technology on the agenda. And then we're going to turn over a section on the agenda to talk about, assets that EPA has to help new technologies develop. And this could be an all-day seminar, so I've been quite a disciplinarian and very thankful with the speakers who are joining us generally on the phone, three of the four. I've given them the chance to do four slides and then a lot of resource materials, their phone number and email address. So some of you may already know a lot about our Small Business Innovative Research Program, our Environmental Technology Verification Program, our Cooperative Research and Development arrangements, and our ability to use our enforcement actions to try out new technologies. If you don't, then this will be your hors d'oeuvre. I would not say we're giving you the main course on each one of these, but there are resources and people available offline, and you'll have their email and phone if you want to get in touch with them. So we're very grateful that they're going to be with us on the phone. And then we're coming to the main course of the meeting, which is I'm going to have just three slides talking about the, as I said, the needs and the regulatory agenda. And we're very grateful that three of you have been recruited to be commentators. So we've asked the folks listed on the agenda to talk for 5 or 6 minutes each, basically to tee up the conversation so that we have the conversation starting. I'm not taking them to lunch, so they don't have to say anything they want to say. They can say this is useful or not useful, but at least we're willing to give comments, and we chose them with some care. As you see on the agenda, Alan Dines is the president of the Midwest University Research Network, which was the main reason that we recruited him. On his day job is assistant director for corporate relations at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, so he knows of this territory of technology development. Also grateful to have Dr. Kathy Banks on the phone from Purdue. She's a researcher of standing and for many years, and so she brings an academic perspective on how university faculty might view these two sets of the set of needs and the regulatory agenda as possible drivers for new technology. And then we have a practitioner, Jeff Pearl, who's president of Chicago Chem Consultants, and they actually do work with the chemical industry putting in technology, so I thought it would be good to hear from a perspective of a practitioner what these documents might mean to them. So I'll try and take a break because I'll need one. Not that the people on the phone can sneak out and take one, but I'll probably take a break for 5 minutes, just for a biology break, about an hour from now, an hour and 15 minutes. So that may cause us to take a quick stop. So I'm going to start now, and I'm moving in the slides for those of you on the phone to the opening presentation, EPA's role in fostering technology. The first slide has the context for promoting new environmental technology on the screen in today's date. Hope you're all with me there. And those of you in the room have copies, I think, of this in your packet. So going to the first slide, the outline for what I'm going to talk about briefly is just a reminder of what our mission is at EPA. Brief commentary, a couple of slides on our operations and how we implement our programs. And then, as I mentioned earlier, two or three slides on the context that we take on environmental technologies as a regulatory agency. So I'm going to the slide that says operations and implementation. No, not, because I have two-sided printing. I'm going to mission and mandate. Sorry, mission and mandate. Just as a reminder, EPA is one of 20 independent regulatory agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Economic Regulatory Agencies, and others that report directly to the President. EPA is not a cabinet agency, although in many other countries the Environment Agency is. But EPA administrators, through several administrations going back a number of years, have been part of cabinet meetings. In the last administration, the EPA administrator attended the Strategic Economic Dialogue talks with China, and in this administration, our administrator attends cabinet meetings as well. So the environment has been integral to what goes on at the highest levels, even though we're not in the cabinet. Our overall mission, as you know, is to protect public health and environment, but that, unlike some other agencies like Interior, which has a kind of an organic mission statement, our mission has grown up, as many of you probably know, by the passage of a number of statutes over the last 40 years, actually, our 40th anniversary next year. The ones you see on the chart there, this is a sample. We have over 20 statutes. Some that are not shown have to do with ocean dumping and marine protection, sanctuaries and research and pollution prevention, but these that I've listed here are the mainline statutes that tend to drive our regulations, the regulatory agenda, and much of what we do. The ones in white there are plastic pollution, in general, pollution control statutes, Safe Drinking Water Act to take things out of the drinking water, Water Pollution Clean Water Act taking things out of the wastewater, et cetera, the Comprehensive Emergency Response Compensation Liability Act, also known as Superfund, to clean up abandoned sites. The two in yellow are colored that way because they're a little unique in that they're federal product regulation statutes. If you take the world of chemicals and divide it up, starting with foods, drugs, and cosmetics, that belongs to FDA. Low-level nuclear materials, like the kind your dentist uses and so forth, are regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission through state health departments, and that leaves pesticides and all the rest of the chemicals. So we have the two statutes that divide up that world. The FIFRA law, as it's called, Fungicides, Insecticides, or Genocide Act, is the one that basically where we register pesticides and label them, even though all of us also have scrubbing bubbles in our bathrooms that say used inconsistent with a label as a federal offense and rose dust, but a large portion of what FIFRA does is for, of course, agriculture and the prosperity of the agricultural industry while we're being safe. Toxic Substance Control Act then handles the rest of chemicals and commerce. There are about 70,000 or so, ranging from gasoline and sulfuric acid to brand new materials like nanomaterials, and that law has encompasses EPA's involvement with those chemicals. So I'm going by fast today without talking about how we regulate, just that we do cover them. The next slide on regulated community is just a reminder that we seem to touch almost everyone who is required to comply with our regs and guidelines. As you see here, some of the statistics, over 20 million small businesses are impacted. Of course, all the units of local government that treat water, drinking water, wastewater, might have garages that have underground tanks. We touch all of those entities in a variety of ways. And so we're deeply involved and intricately involved then with the states and tribes to implement all these programs, because obviously the 17,000 people at EPA aren't going to be interacting directly with these many, many regulated entities. Going on to operations and implementation, this is just a reminder that we have these multiple statutes, kind of digging in a little bit here on how we connect with technologies, and obviously we exercise discretion when we write regulations, and under each statute there's an instruction on how we exercise that discretion. Most of the regulations are written in headquarters. We've written down here some of the traditional ways in which we regulate. Those of you who follow the water program, we tend to use best available control technology as a way in which to set the emission limits for effluent guidelines, for example. In the air area, there's a whole set of acronyms here for reasonably available control technology, best available control technology, lowest achievable environmental emission reduction. Those are different acronyms that are embedded in the regulations for setting how we set up emissions in air. We also are involved setting national ambient air quality standards, for example, for particulates, for SOx, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide. We set a national level that we want to reach in the ambient environment, and then we back that up into what the sources that discharge into the environment, and that leads then to permits that are given to power plants, to chemical industry, to small sources that feed that larger standard. We are engaged in emission trading within the Air Act for sulfur dioxide and acid rain reduction. Other statutes use risk assessment balanced with other factors. That's an example from the Superfund statute where we have to balance the risk to the public health and the environment with reliability and another five or six factors that are used to set up the risk management at Superfund sites. The TSCA, Toxic Substance Law, calls upon us to not allow unreasonable risk, which is a much more difficult concept to
to deal with, but nonetheless is the threshold for exercising our discretion. So the point of this slide is to say that not every one of our statutes do we do our work based on the technology, but a lot of them have that embedded in there, which was a choice rather than trying out in the 1970s to figure out risk assessment, which has come of age in the last 10 years. There was a driving force to at least get best available or reasonable available technologies, and that, of course, has driven a lot of environmental improvement in the last 40 years. In more recent times, on the next slide, I'm looking at operations implementation continued. We've gone beyond command and control. We've had a variety of programs together with headquarters and the regions. Notable among them, well, as you know, the IRS counts on 80% of us trying to pay our taxes if we can figure out how to do it, and thanks to having products on the computer, we generally do. So we've had to take on compliance assistance as a way to deal with these thousands of gas stations, print shops, and dry cleaners and others that might have a hazardous waste or other problems, and work with their, usually often their trade associations or other nonprofits to help give them information so that they could comply if they knew how to comply with the various regulations. So that's been growing in the last decade, as has a number of partnership programs that we've established that turned out to be really timely in this age of more focus on greenhouse gases. Most of you have Energy Star computers, I imagine, but there are other waste-wise and climate-wise programs that we've partnered with industry to try and reduce emissions voluntarily. We also are integrally involved in partnering for economic gain. The classic example of that is the Brownfields program, where we give small grants, $100,000 to cities, to help them take pieces of property that are perceived to be contaminated, whether or not they are, and turn them to an economic purpose that then causes the redevelopment. And so that, in the words of one of our former administrators, we try and make environmental protection a building block, not a stumbling block to economic development. You'll also be hearing about cooperative research and development agreements, where we partner with industry and developers of technology in our labs or with them, even not in our own labs. Going on behind the scenes, of course, in the back room in the last 15 years has been a surge of interest in international standards. Many corporations in the U.S. and others, as some of you may be in the room, have adopted ISO 14000, the Environmental Quality Standards, EMS systems, and those systems and adopting those systems generally drive those organizations to environmental improvement, even without us doing anything. And so that tends to be something corporations and others may choose to do to compete worldwide. And also further in the back room behind that are the developments that both the European Union and China are imposing for their own economies, and so that companies who want to sell in the Union or in China may be meeting requirements that we would not specify for hazardous materials reduction or recycling and reuse, even though that helps our overall environment by building that into our products and services that are sold in those economies. And beyond this, of course, undergirding all this is a strong enforcement program that we run in order to make sure that those who do want to comply and even go beyond compliance are rewarded by that by not looking across the street at their neighbor who is not complying and, quote, getting away with it. So we have both a regular civil enforcement program, and for the really bad guys, we have a criminal enforcement program with gun-toting agents who carry handcuffs when we need to get the bad guys. The next slide is just a reminder for beyond those. I know there's some people on the phone not in our region, but we follow the standard 10 regional organization. So we're operating here in Region 5, the six states that surround Lake Michigan roughly, and or touch on the Great Lakes. And you see the other major regions where our various interests and the problems differ, of course, surrounding the Chesapeake Bay than they do in the Southwest in Region 9. Continuing on to operations and implementation continued after that slide is just a cut at our people. I mentioned we have about 17,000 federal employees. FTE stands for full-time equivalent. That means one person working full-time all year. And about half of those are in our regional offices. Most, and I alluded to this earlier, but my one public administration civics comment for the morning is that the vast amount of environmental protection in the United States is not done by the Environmental Protection Agency. It's done by states, it's done by tribes, it's done by local governments, and were it not for our partnership with them, we would not have the kind of improved environment that we share today. So we're very grateful, as always, to those partnerships. They're essential to reaching all those thousands of affected parties that I mentioned earlier. The about 2,400 of our full-time equivalent people are connected with science and technology work. Many of them, as the slides say, are in the Office of Research and Development. But about a third of EPA employees are scientists and engineers, even here in the region and in headquarters. So we're a science and engineering agency at heart, because, including the natural and physical sciences, because of the kind of work we do, as you saw earlier, by the kind of regs that we write and the kind of statutes that we execute. Of our research budget, of about $760 million that the Office of Research and Development has, about $440 million goes to extramural work outside the agency as opposed to our own research. Moving on to the slide on EPA's roles, this is the light bulbs are supposed to indicate more or less emphasis, expertise, practice in these areas. When I said earlier that we are not the primary funding agent, that's why there's only one light bulb there. Our extramural, investigator-initiated extramural research programs, peer-reviewed, I think is in the order of $60 million a year. National Science Foundation extramural research program is $6 billion a year. So we're certainly not the big dog on the porch, but for our niche, that doesn't mean NSF only funds environmental research. We are a niche. We are not the main funder, as I mentioned earlier, those other agencies. We also do some technology development. There actually are folks, to pick one of my favorite examples, at our Ann Arbor lab near the automotive industry, who men and women there who have screwdrivers and develop new technologies and get patents and try out new technologies. But in general, we're not a technology development agency. That's not the kind of research and development we carry out. We're not a DOE with tech transfer functions of that scale. I mentioned NSF and even some of the NIs of H. We're not at that level in-house. We get three light bulbs because we are our main role, our perception in around the beltway, around the country as a regulator and enforcer. And that brings with it sometimes a reluctance to engage with us on this subject, the neutral subject of technology development, because people don't want to bring up their problems or they don't want to discuss what they might be doing optionally. And so that is a barrier, I think, for us to be able to engage with particularly entrepreneurs and technology vendors versus university researchers, but still a partial barrier. But it is our main role. And we would argue, as you'll hear later in my presentation, that the regs drive new technologies. We have needs. They are going to be coming down the road, and maybe one of you or your colleagues or other universities or other entrepreneurs have an idea that will help meet that need and finance your condo in Bermuda. We also have a major role. We try to practice as an information broker. We don't choose winners. We don't have ways in which to pick one technology over the others, but we do maintain databases. People are available to talk on the phone. We know about technologies, but we are a neutral agent. We don't, as I say, pick out the one over others that might be useful. And our main role, where we can, you'll be hearing more from Maggie Crow later, is as a verification agent. Just to give that part of the agenda a commercial, one of the main reasons that we've discovered over the years that environmental technologies have a difficulty in acceptance is that, the person who might be acquiring that technology, generally it's a cost center, and so they don't want to take on a new technology and have it not work or not meet the specifications that the vendor claims it can meet. So having a verification program was the result of a conference, the White House conference in the mid-90s, that said if there were a neutral arbiter who could verify vendor claims and lay those out in a quality-controlled fashion, that would help technologies succeed. And, in fact, that's what we've done, and you'll hear about that a little bit later. We get a couple of light bulbs for being a partner in deployment. We can work in partnership. Not only the CRADA program you're going to hear about a little bit later, which is more on the development side, but we have been involved, especially when we've had congressional direction, to try out new technologies. We ran a massive program to try and demonstrate new technologies to remove arsenic from drinking water in small communities, which is a major issue because of the costs and trying to drive down costs and get the kind of removal that we need. So we've had a variety of demonstration programs over the years that have come and gone as based on funding and statutes, but we're not in that business funding that in any organized every year kind of basis. And finally, we'd love to be, but we're not generally we're not a user first resort. When I take phone calls from technology developers and they want to tell me about their technology, and then I said, we'd like to help you with these various programs we have, but we don't buy technology at EPA. In general, we do some in the area of monitoring and measurement because we do that for our own account, but in general, we're out observing the scene, working with state and local governments on monitoring and measurement, and of course we're working with owners and operators of industries and responsible parties, and they and the consulting engineers they employ are the ones buying technologies. So in general, talking to us about being a user of first resort is not very useful. However, one of the needs lists that you were sent for this meeting and that you have is from the General Services Administration, our partner across the street here in Region 5, and they have a number of needs that they'd like to try out in their own buildings, and they are a user of first resort. So we do have something for those of you who are involved in energy and other kinds of waste reduction technologies from the GSA list that we might take questions on later. Going to the next slide. This is a slide that you're not expected to read, but other than to see that there's an arrow across the top that follows the research development demonstration through the valley of death to commercialization of new technologies. You have the listing of the website, www.epa.gov/epop, and that's where this slide comes from. And basically, we've taken about 20 or 25 of our EPA programs. I mentioned the investigator-initiated peer review program. That's on this chart. I mentioned the men and women in Ann Arbor with the screwdrivers. That's on this chart. And you see where the various programs fall that EPA has, be it research, development, and you see on the right side under diffusion, you can look on the arrow and see all the colored bars. We're very much more into diffusion and information dissemination about technologies, as I argued on my previous slide, than we are into development and demonstration. Okay, I'm on the last three slides. I'm running pretty much on schedule, actually. The slide titled Intersections, EPA's Work in Environmental Technology. These are my summary slides, trying to make the points that I've alluded to earlier and increase your understanding of our perceptions of how we operate in the marketplace for environmental technology. As I mentioned earlier, there are some niche areas where we have an in-depth understanding of technologies. So I alluded earlier to drinking water and arsenic, where we have a cadre of people who've gotten some experience on small drinking water plants. We've done some major applications work on air pollution control technology from power plants, on continuous mercury emission monitoring. We have a lot of experience we've developed because of the diesel retrofit program that we fund nationally and sponsor, so we've learned about diesel retrofit technologies for everything from school buses to locomotives. So there are, I'm not saying we're not connected with technology, but there are niches across our portfolio. So any given subject, we may not be very deep because we're not involved in the way we are in these technologies. We have a secondary level of understanding of a much broader group of technology. I mentioned all the BACTs and LEARs, and where do we figure out how to write those regulations? In general, we hire consultants or contractors, and they go out and study. If we're going to write an effluent guideline for the pulp and paper industry, we'd go out and study the best operating pulp and paper plants and find out what the best available control technology is for ammonia or whatever the contaminant is, and bring those results back in and use that information from those best of class in order to write our regulations. So that's what I mean by there's a cadre of people with a secondary level of knowledge about a lot of industry sectors, but we're not actually out working side by side as we are in the first bullet of this slide. So that's a much larger population generally in headquarters. And then we have a variety, because of these partnering programs, we have a broad appreciation, I think, for technology as it impacts the operation of industry sectors, obviously the energy conservation programs and the ones we have for climate-wise and greenhouse gas reduction. We've had to learn about those sectors and how we might help them get technical assistance, reducing their greenhouse gases. Design for the Environment is a program in our pesticide and toxic substances where we have actually partnered with, for example, the chip industry, not the chip industry, but those who design the circuit board industry, to work with them jointly on how to use non-acidic methods to take the circuits off the boards, how to do drilling that's less environmentally, more environmentally friendly, that kind of thing. So through a variety of partnerships, again, we've gotten niche knowledge of different kinds of technology. But my overall message is we're not deep in many areas, but we do have some knowledge, depending on whether it's regional headquarters, in a variety of technology areas. Going on to the next slide on observations, I've already made the first point once, so I won't say it again. Secondly, we tend to view new environmental problems through our statutory and regulatory lens. So the example I picked here is with the advent of our interest in greenhouse gases and the need to sequester greenhouse gases and the proposal of a rule on how to do that. We look at that through the lens of the acronym here, the Underground Injection Control Program. That's a regulatory program that we in the states operate. We can't inject hazardous waste and other things into the ground without getting a permit, either we or the states give. So that would be the obvious program through which we would enter the issue of how do we take CO2 and inject it into the subsurface and the groundwater or far deeper segments and then know that it's going to stay there, measure it, and so forth. So it's what I mean by when some new problem arises, we tend to view it through one of our regulatory lenses and then figure out how to, and those people who work on those regulations then get smart. We actually had this summer, I was on the elevator here in our building with the guy writing the UIC regulations for greenhouse gas sequestration, and we were discussing what do we know about the technologies? And he said, well, of course, the oil and gas industry has been injecting fluids into the subsurface for 50 years in Southwest Texas and other places, but not CO2. And so the whole issue is we know something about how to hook up the valves and fittings and how to inject, but how do we measure, how do we monitor, how do we know that the soda water is not going to leave the building underneath the ground and so forth. So that's the way we come at some technologies. So I mentioned earlier that while we're expert in niches, we're not engaged in comprehensive technology monitoring. So what that means is if you called up a person here in the region or in headquarters and wanted to talk about treatment, your new treatment technology for selenium in wastewater, we may know something about that, but we may not. We have no one sitting at their desk just waiting to study technologies that have to do with wastewater treatment. It has to do with whether they're working on an effluent guideline. That's the lens they're looking through, or whether they're looking at it through some new program in the AIR program. And we have an Environmental Technology Council that meets regularly. I'm going to keep going on my next slide. We talked about the regulatory agenda. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And these are a couple of comments that we're aware that by virtue of our regulations where we choose the best available technology, what that does is it fixes the technology, and there's very little incentive for the regulatory community to try something better because they know if they adopt that approach, that will get them compliance, get their permit, they'll be reporting no violations. And so the very thing that drives our regulation turns out to be a curse if you're a new technology developer trying to get in the door, candy store, because why does a company that needs to comply want to try something new? If it's cheaper, of course, that might help. And we're well vested in diffusion, and we have some experience with SBIR. So I'm now over by almost 8 minutes, but I'd like to, when I stop finally talking, and I'd like to take a question two in the room here, if there are any, and then I'll ask if there's anybody on the phone. We have about 50 people here in the room and 24 or 25 on the phone, so I'm going to ask if, after I take a question in the room, if there are any, I'm going to see if anybody in Ohio Michigan or Indiana has a question on the phone first, but I'm going to go in the room first here. Does anybody want to break the ice with a question on what I've just thrown at you so fast? The why, what, or how? Yes. Yes, sir. The question was, we have had a program that demonstrates technologies in the Superfund program. Do we have anything like that for clean water and wastewater treatment? I think the short answer is no. Actually, the program that did demonstrate technology in Superfund is over. It's called the SITE program, Superfund Innovative Technology Evaluation, and a lot of that parade had gone by the last 5 years, so it hasn't been funded in the last 5 or 6 years. Okay, any of the folks on the phone in the states I mentioned to start with have a question? How about everybody else? Anybody else on the phone with the rest of the... Okay. We can stick with our agenda then. We're now ready to turn our attention to the assets. I didn't check in before I launched. Valerie Blank, are you on the phone with us now?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Say that again. I'm sorry. Somebody sneezed. I can't hear you.
Hi, this is Valerie. Can you hear me okay?
You're going to have to speak much louder when we get to you, but I just wanted to make sure you were on. Thanks.
Okay.
So let me start with the four programs I mentioned where I was the sergeant major and made them limit themselves to four slides so we could have 8 minutes apiece. That doesn't mean you're limited to questions. That just means we've got to get through this in about 35 minutes. So April Richards is on the phone. She's the deputy program manager in headquarters for EPA's Small Business Innovative Research Program. And April, we're looking at the slide here with your name on it, which is the first one on SBIR. So why don't you
take... Great. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're coming through fine on the speakers.
Okay, super. So again, this is April Richards. I'm going to give you a brief overview of EPA's Small Business Innovation Research Program. So I think someone's going to advance the slides for me. If we could go to the next slide, please.
We're there.
Okay, great. So SBIR is actually a government-wide program. There's 11 federal agencies with SBIR programs. And the intent of the program is to support small businesses to develop technologies that agencies need. The definition of small business means smaller than 500 employees. And agencies like DOD, NSF, DOE all have very big SBIR programs. And all these agencies use the program to develop technologies that help them meet their mission. It's an automatic set-aside, the budget, and this year it equals over $2.3 billion. So it's actually a really large pocket of research money, especially relative to sort of shrinking research budgets elsewhere. So across the federal government, $2.3 billion in SBIR. Now, for example, the Department of Defense does have $1 billion of that in their SBIR program alone. So you can kind of imagine what the other agencies have. SBIR is built around a phased approach. So phase one of the program is to prove technical feasibility, and phase two is to promote commercialization of the technology. And we'll go to the next slide. I want to tell you a little bit about a collaboration that we have going on right now with the National Science Foundation. The goal is just to increase the commercialization of environmental technologies. And what we found is the NSF actually funds quite a bit of environmental technology through their SBIR program. And just looking at the bullets here, I'll give you a little comparison of our programs. In 2009, of the Phase 1 projects, EPA received 500 proposals, which is great. People are definitely thinking green. We got a lot of proposals. We had almost 100 pass our peer review, but we're only going to fund 40. NSF received 1,740 proposals and will fund closer to 300. Here's the real bottom line. Is EPA's SBIR budget is $5 million and NSF is over $175 million. NSF gives larger phase one amounts, they give larger phase two amounts, so it all adds up to the fact that we are collaborating and leveraging off of NSF's robust SBIR budget, and we really want to help them get more high-quality environmental technologies funded, so we're trying to help folks think about National Science Foundation as a place to apply, as well as applying to EPA's SBIR program. Okay, next slide, please, number five. And I just wanted to let folks know what some of the hot topic areas are for us. This is actually our solicitation topics for this year, 2009. They will change somewhat for our next solicitation, which will be in spring of 2010. But in general, they'll be similar to this. So green building, innovation in manufacturing, which is a sort of pollution prevention approach to manufacturing, nanotechnology, greenhouse gases, drinking water and water monitoring, water infrastructure, monitoring and control of air pollution, biofuels and vehicle emission reduction, waste management and monitoring, and homeland security. And if you read our solicitation, obviously we go into a lot more detail about each topic, but those are the 10 general topics that we'll be funding next year. And finally, last slide, just for some more information. Again, we're encouraging people to look at the National Science Foundation. They do have a solicitation open right now. It will close in December. So if you are really ready to submit a proposal, you could look at submitting to NSF short term. If you're thinking maybe longer term, EPA has a solicitation opening again in May. It opens in March of next year, closes in May of 2010. And there will be a second NSF Phase 1 solicitation, which will close in June. So in theory, you could apply to EPA and NSF. If you got funded by one, you could withdraw your proposal from the other agency. Here's our website, has last year's solicitation on it for more information, has a database of all the projects we've ever funded, and some success stories of projects that have had commercial success. And here is contact information for myself. I'm the Deputy Program Manager, and Jim Gallup, who is the Program Manager. So if you have questions, you're more than welcome to call us and get more information. That's it for me.
Thanks, April. One of the reasons you guys who are on the phone and those in the room are privileged is the people who didn't come didn't get this special insight that if you go to the SBIR website listed here, Jim and April have actually mapped EPA's technology interests into the NSF solicitation. So it actually says if you're interested, isn't something like this, April says, if you're interested in green buildings, you call so-and-so, or this is their email address in NSF, if you're interested in wastewater, like that, is that not right?
That's exactly right. So for the 10 topics that I mentioned, they are all covered somewhere in the NSF solicitation. We show you where to go in their solicitation to look for that topic, and also a program manager contact there that you could call to run your technology by.
So you beat out all those universities today, those of you who are here, and other developers, because you know the secret and they don't, which is you can
track
those NSF leads. And that deadline, I think, is December 9th, so we're not...
I believe that's right.
...know about that. But we wanted... That was a special reason to have this topic on the agenda. It was not only as our normal SBIR program, but this partnership with NSF that Jim and April have fashioned. We're ready for questions in the room, and then I'll take questions from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois first after I get one in the room. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Bob Patrick, and are there plans?
Get your mic.
Are there plans to have working associations with other agencies like Department of Energy or USDA? Because there's a lot of overlapping interests and focus on technologies between those agencies?
That's a great question. We do work with all 11 agencies. We do meet regularly with the program managers, but sort of the devil's in the details. We've tried to work with DOE more closely to kind of, if we had a great project, to see if DOE would maybe want to fund phase two, but it's just never really worked out because of the way they develop their solicitations, the way their topics work their way up. They're very specific. EPA is a little more general, and NSF is even more general. So as it works out, NSF is sort of the easiest to work with because almost everything we fund, they fund. But We can try to help you if you want to get into another agency, but the working relationship isn't as close as this one that we've managed to create with NSF.
But I think the point is, from a developer's point of view, or rather than government institution's point of view, if you win an SBIR Phase 1 at EPA, you could go on, could you not, and win a Phase 2 somewhere else, April? Is that right?
Rarely.
Rarely?
Rarely, yeah. So normally the agency that funds Phase 1 is the one that would fund Phase 2.
But you're not ineligible to reapply to the other agency.
Most agencies, you have to start at Phase 1, if that's what you're asking. Yeah.
Right. Fair enough. On the fire, one more in the room? Yes, sir.
My name is Vince Cushing, and we've steered away from SBIRs because there's a requirement that the federal government that gets to use our technology has some rights to our technology. You guys are a really big market for us. Does EPA ever relax, or does NSF ever relax that requirement?
Actually, for SBIR, I mean, SBIR is not for everyone, but SBIR, the company completely retains their IP. The government takes no control over the technology whatsoever, so that's really not right. We really, companies don't want to participate if they're going to lose their IP. So we, the program, again, completely lets the company retain that. So.
Well, I guess we're countering that intellectual property belongs to the company. I guess you have an experience to counter that. I'll repeat.
Right. It belongs to me, intellectual property. The government has the right to use it for free.
Oh, on some use, yes, you're talking about. The issue is using the technology later, I guess, April?
It's to use it for free. I have to say I've never heard of that. And again, you know, EPA is really not usually the end user anyway.
We sell in commercial buildings. My technology works in commercial buildings. TSA has a lot of commercial buildings.
Right.
I'd like to use my technology for free.
Oh. Okay. Well. On the phone, can I get somebody in Wisconsin, in Illinois, Indiana? Elsewhere on the phone?
This is Joel Dorkin from Missouri.
Hi, Joel. Good morning.
And I was looking, it's on slide 5 of that. You'd mentioned that there was some mapping available for linking, like, the green building technologies, innovation and manufacturing to direct contacts.
Yes, it's on that web address for the SBIR side of the EPA.
Okay, the EPA.
There might not be a direct contact for every single topic, but there's certainly multiple contacts there sort of based on what you're interested in. The mapping is really from topic to topic, and then there's several contacts within NSF that you could get in touch with.
Okay, and is that the mapping that does exist, is that within the HTML link for Phase 1?
Yeah, it probably is. It's in it's something that would be called an EPA-NSF fact sheet.
Okay.
And it would be a PDF file off the website.
I think I found it. Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, and call me if you can't find it.
Stay in the room again. Yes. Last question, we're going to move on.
Okay. Hi, it's Alan Dines, University of Wisconsin-Madison. April, you mentioned one out of five of the proposals EPA received passed peer review. I wonder if you could comment just briefly, where do people stumble? Why only one out of five?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have a really good third-party peer review that we do. The intent of peer review is to make sure that the proposals are strong technically and commercially. So even in Phase 1, you have to think about the commercial potential of your technology. Who would be the end user? What general cost? Who's your competition? And I think probably that's where people fall down a bit. They have a really good idea, but they haven't really thought it out too much about what would the application be and who would use it. But there's five criteria in our solicitation, and I just encourage people to make sure they address those five criteria thoroughly.
Okay. We have April's number. We're going to press on and move to Valerie Blank, who's going to talk briefly about the cooperative research and development agreements, which are basically an entity or a function under the Federal Technology Transfer Act. Valerie, why don't you we're on your first slide, and as I say, you probably have to talk a little bit louder because your phone was a little muffled.
Okay, well, just let me know if I'm not coming through clearly, and I will speak up. So I just start with a high-level introduction to who we are and what we do. The focus of our technology transfer program is on getting technologies developed by EPA into the marketplace, and this also helps us in addressing the agency mission, as Walt has described and talked about this a little bit. So I won't go into the lenses, the scope and responsibility of the parts of EPA, but I do want to mention that our EPA tech transfer program is managed out of our Office of Research and Development's Office of Science and Policy. So if you go to the next slide, so what is the agency's FTTA program? FTTA is also a federal government-wide program. We here implement the Federal Technology Transfer Act and related tech transfer laws agency-wide. So even though our program is housed within our Office of Research and Development, we implement the program across the agency. And the program provides for collaboration with outside entities and assists in the transfer of federal technologies into the marketplace. We also work with the EPA laboratories to protect EPA's intellectual property through patents and licensing, and we do so in coordination with our Office of General Counsel. So there are a number of mechanisms we can use, and the most common of these, as Walt had mentioned, is the Cooperative Research and Development Agreement. And so I'm just going to talk about that a little bit today. Cooperative research and development agreements are established between EPA and a research partner, and we can exchange personnel, equipment, services, and expertise for a specific research project. One thing that I do want to call out is this is not like an EPA grant program where we can provide funding. EPA cannot provide funding through these collaborations. However, as I mentioned, we can provide in-kind through expertise and use of our facilities. And so we actually have been very successful on average over the past 5 years. We've been able to, per year, have creative resources, pool resources of about $8 million per year, and it's pretty evenly split between EPA and collaborative resources, but, you know, we're small, and when you compare our FTTA program to other government agencies like DOD and DOE, but we're really pretty successful. And so just to get back to the CRADAs will allow non-federal partners to work directly with us on collaborative research and technology development projects. We can also use licensing agreements so that outside entities can license our EPA patented products, but also to further development technologies that EPA may have developed. And so I talked a little bit about the benefits in terms of leveraging. There are benefits to both collaborators. For example, EPA partners can use our research to develop better products for the marketplace. Also, to work with them on something that they may have developed, but to bring EPA's expertise into a development project. And benefits from the partner perspective, again, the external expertise that they can bring in from EPA, product development, and funding. So if you go to the next slide, so we have a lot of successful stories that, as April mentioned, they highlight those on their website. We do on ours as well, but I just wanted to give one example of an EPA university collaboration. And in this case, our National Risk Management Research Laboratory collaborated with the University of Cincinnati in developing a biomass concentrate reactor for biological treatment of water. The BCR design included aeration and a membrane system to retain all the biomass within the aeration chamber, and its simple operation and low maintenance requirements may make it more economically feasible than other water treatment technologies where there's a need for biomass retention for biodegradation. And so one of the things that EPA and the university have been able to do through CRADA partnerships is to demonstrate its effectiveness in treating MTB contaminated groundwater. And EPA and the university continue to partner with other companies to further develop the BCR to its commercial applications. This is just one example of how we've worked with universities through CRADIS patents and licensing. Our National Center for Computational Toxicology is also expanding information sharing with university partners through its ToxCast program. And you can get more information about other FTPA collaborations on our website and also the NCCP and how they've really successfully leveraged the work that they're doing and outside partners are doing in the area of CompTox on their website. And so if you go to the next slide, in summary, EPA has expertise in many environmental technology areas. Walt talked about many of the niche areas, and it's interesting to hear him talk about those. Some of the areas that are included in the current SBIRS solicitation. We have researchers that have established CRADAs with many outside partners touching in a lot of those niche areas and research areas that EPA works in. So it's an opportunity to collaborate on research and development within a lab's focus or mission area through the FTPA program. I also just wanted to mention, again, we're housed within the Office of Research and Development, but we work with other research laboratories within the agency. So the Office of Air has laboratories or facilities in Ann Arbor. We do a lot of work with them and with outside partners in collaborating on work, and some of our regional laboratories as well. And you can, there's a link here to a list of all of the EPA laboratories, so that'll give you a sense of some of the areas of expertise. And if you have an interest in working with a scientist on one of those, we're certainly happy to help you facilitate getting something started. And you can contact myself or Sarah Bauer, who is our FTPA program coordinator.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Valerie. So the message here is that, like a lot of other federal agencies, we have an interest, of course, in patenting, licensing the technologies we do develop, but that's a more modest amount than those other agencies I mentioned. But the idea of being able to use our labs and facilities jointly and preserve the intellectual property that belongs to the owner and try out things in facilities you may not be able to try them out elsewhere. So that's the gist of this particular item. Questions in the room here? Yes, sir. Back to Bob.
Is there any help on communication between the EPA and the states? As you mentioned earlier, the states are really responsible for a lot of the environmental regulations application and so on. So I was just wondering if there's a communication between if you do any kind of communications with the states.
Well, the answer is yes. In better times than these, where states are not faced with layoffs and not working every day of every week, we've had meetings with the research side of the environmental commissioners of the states called ECOS. There's an organization called ARIS that they sponsor, and that's their research arm. And when ECOS has its national meetings, we've tried to connect up with different committees. They have themselves organized into air and water and waste on the technology subject. So the overall answer is yes. As far as going individually to a state on a specific technology, we haven't done that in the region, but the subject's been broached with states, and as I say, when times are better and states aren't just worrying about getting payroll done rather than being able to be a little more visionary, we've tried to engage them.
Can I cheat and take the second question?
Okay.
Anybody that's worked with Congress gets the feeling that the information flow comes from Congress to the agencies. Is there an advisory group in the EPA for environmental programs for congressional offices or aides or what on, so that the congressman gets a little bit more technically adept at some of these things?
Well, I mean, we, of course, answer questions that Congress asks. So in general, the Office of Research and Development, which Valerie sits in and Maggie does here in a minute. Maybe that mic. Mike, Howard, why don't you take that mic back? Maybe that's coming. Sorry. I'll give it back to you in a second. So we're often on the Hill, those staffs, talking about budget items, appropriation items, and the whole efforts going on now on greenhouse gas controls and what to do about climate change. There'll be people shuttling up there from the AIR program and others talking about both economic and technical analyses. So there's a regular conversation with congressional staffs, but it tends to be about either a budget we're getting ready to put forward or one that we have, or there's oversight going on. I mean, that's my general answer. I mean, I've been on those meetings, and I know they go on continuously. We have a whole congressional relations staff that picks up technical people and makes sure they go up and have those meetings. So, yes, is the overall answer. One more in the room, and then we'll go on the phone. Yes, sir. Go ahead. Yes.
At the outset, there with the CRADA, there would not have been any money changing hands between the university and
right.
EPA, and the university doesn't have any money, and EPA wasn't providing any. So how does the technology actually get developed? I mean, where does the funding come from?
Well, I think it has to. I'll start, Valerie. Maybe you want to correct me, but it has to do with jointness of interest. For example, if you were working on something new on nanotechnology, but you didn't have a lab that would allow you to handle those materials, and we did, it's something you're working on anyway. It's something we're working on. It isn't a new funding. It's furthering joint objectives. We have people following, say, the ecological effects of nano. They have a lab that allows them to test out those materials. You have that interest, but you can't do it in your lab. It's that kind of arrangement. It's not that helps. It's not new funding, per se. It's jointness of interest. That's why they have this directory of labs on that slide you just saw, where you can look up and see what is available. I mean, my lab here in Region 5 is a traditional lab, does a lot of environmental monitoring and sampling, but we're also doing, for example, analysis of Homeland Security chemical agents and their daughter products in order to how to develop methods to analyze those. So it's a matter of matching up jointness of interest rather than funding new ideas. So if you had, again, if you didn't have a facility and the researcher was getting an NSF grant and you wanted to do something jointly, you could do that. Is there anything else you want to add, Valerie? I jumped in the middle of that.
No, that's right. Jointness of interest and then jointness of expertise. You know, when I talk about the $8 million on average, it really is an estimation of in kind. So, you know, what you're working with in your lab, or perhaps you have expertise in one part of method development, but you might want to work with a university where they've had some experience in implementing or using it in a certain way.
I'm going to try the phone first as we have more in the room. Does anybody on the phone have a question? Okay. Back to the room. Yes, hi.
Hello, this is Stan Selig with Waterless Cleaning. Are any of these projects that you're currently working on publicized that maybe some other people may be able to contribute?
Are the CRADA projects?
Yes.
Yes, I believe that we have a listing of some of our CRADA projects on the website. We have a listing of all of our patented technologies on the website, so that can give you a sense of where we, you know, have researchers that have particular interests or expertise. It may not speak to all of the creatives that they have in place, but it certainly will give you a sampling of what's out there.
But that wouldn't be current. That would be past projects you worked on.
Well, it's technologies that researchers have developed, but we may have current licenses in place or current creatives in place to further develop it. But, you know, I certainly, if it's not there, can look into that. There is some sensitivity, of course, with folks wanting to share that information, but it certainly would be helpful to have that available.
So I think
get a sense of ongoing projects.
Look on the website and
yeah,
call
sure.
Valerie, I think, is the next step if there's something that you're really honing in on. Anybody else on the phone?
Yes, Walt, I'm here.
Annette
Johnston.
I want to see if any other questions, Maggie, but I guess not. So we're going to press on and switch to our third asset discussion, which is environmental technology verification. So we have that slide on the screen, and Maggie Thoreau is going to be doing the talking. Thank you, Valerie.
Can you all hear me properly?
Yep.
Okay. So we're on the first slide, which is Environmental Technology Verification Program Introduction, and just to introduce myself, I work with the Environmental Technology Assessment and Verification Group, and we are located in the Office of Research and Development at EPA in the National Risk Management Research Laboratory. I work with Teresa Harton, who's the director of the ETAP group that I'm in, and also the Environmental Technology Verification Program. So let's go to the next slide, which the top should say. I'm just waiting for mine to appear. ETV objective. The objective of the ETV program is to provide credible performance information for commercial-ready technologies. And by doing that, we help a number of people. The purchasers, the policy makers, and the regulators, EPA, the states, the vendors and technology developers, like those of you in the room and on the phone, and financiers. And I have to say that in my 10 years of EPA experience working with innovative technologies, I have found the ETV program really makes a difference for technology developers. If a technology has third-party verification data from a credible organization like the ETV program, then the acceptance by purchasers and regulators is so much easier. And I cannot say that enough times. It really has made a difference for the technology developers I've spoken with over the years. So the next slide gets into looking at ETV at a glance, and this is very quick because I only have a few minutes here. Just to let you know that ETV is a stakeholder-driven process. We have over 300 stakeholders who are active in advisory groups and technology and technical panels, and the stakeholders are represented from the following types of groups, technology users, technology purchasers, state and local and regulators, trade associations, relevant financial and insurance institutions, EPA program offices and regulators, and other federal agencies. So that gives you a sense of who the stakeholders are. And the stakeholders help to identify the priority technology categories that we're going to verify. They develop the test protocols and the quality assurance plans with EPA and our cooperative partners, which I'll talk about in a minute, and they even help identify vendors and collaborators. And some of the stakeholders end up being our collaborators. And that gets to the third bullet, which is the collaborators and the vendors cost-sharing leverage of ETV. Back a few years ago, it was about 50% of our total funds came from the vendors and the collaborators. In 2008 to 2009, it's 80 to 90%. Of the funding comes from the collaborators and the vendors. And the types of collaborators we've had over the years include several states. I'm not even going to get into naming who. DOD has been a significant collaborator, especially through the ESTCP program, which is the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program. The Navy, NYSERDA, which is the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, EPA program offices have funded verifications, the Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Coast Guard, DOE in a few cases, not as much as we would like to see, Illinois Clean Coal Institute, water utilities, environmental engineers, just to give you a sense of who those collaborators are. And this has enabled us to do, over the years, 420 technologies that we have tested, and verifications are up on the website on those technologies. And 90 protocols have been completed since the beginning of the program in 1995. We have a number of case studies that are up on the website as well, and the website is listed there. We get over 1.5 million hits per year. There's also a growing ETV international effort, which I should just say, which is comprised of several countries. A number of them have their own verification programs. The EU is very involved in this. And there's a real effort going on right now to develop a global verification system so that we could verify once and accept everywhere. And let's go to the next slide. So the next slide should say the listing of our 6 ETV centers. Our website will give much more information on each of these centers, but just so that you have a sense of what they cover. And for each of our centers, we have a cooperative partnership agreement with an outside laboratory organization like the DEHL or the National Sanitary Foundation, which international, which is under the drinking water systems, or the Southern Research Institute. So in each, for each of these centers, we have this outside cooperative partner, and we have an agreement with them, and they help us conduct the verifications. And as I said, the website lists the upcoming verification topics, verification statements for verifications that have already been, for technologies that have been verified. It also has the protocols, much more about how the stakeholder process works, listing of stakeholders, and, you know, in the question time, if there are questions on this, I can go into what the types of technologies each of these centers has been verifying. And then if we go to the next slide, here's a case study for drinking water treatment, and this is just a quick look at something, an example showing the impact that ETV has for verifying new membranes for drinking water to remove microbials. You can see here that, you know, up to 2,200 small drinking water systems will need to meet the options in this rule that EPA has. And we have verified three microfiltration and six ultrafiltration membranes. The city of Pittsburgh here has said that they've declared savings of over $5 million over the conventional treatment by purchasing the system that as a result of our verifications. We have about 25% of market penetration of these verified membranes. And it can have a huge impact on the savings for pilot testing, preventing cases of cryptosporidiosis, and then also just realizing the economic benefits from the health savings. So everyone, as we said, when we conduct verifications, everyone benefits, the purchasers of the technologies, the regulators, the vendors and technology developers, the financial institutions, and the range of people. And then if we go to the last slide, that will give us the contact information for the program. You can reach Teresa Harton at her email address or at her telephone number, and the same thing for me. And then I would highly recommend visiting the ETV website. You can visit each one of the centers to find out further information about the topics that they're currently verifying and the verifications that they've already produced. Okay, Walt, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Maggie. So that's a very quick snapshot. Basically, you saw that over these decades, 400-some technologies. Those of you who go to the Water Environment Federation or the Air Pollution Control Association or the other trade associations will often see vendors at their booths with a report from a verification that's taken place as a way to get an advantage over a competitor. So questions in the room about this? Yes, Jeff. Pearl. Got a mic coming?
Yeah, hi, Jeff Pearl, Chicago Chem Consultants. Can you explain how people access this program? Does it cost money? If I have a new technology, can I just bring it in and get it demonstrated and proven out? How does this work? It's a great idea.
Okay. Yes, Jeff, it does cost money. And in one of the slide on ETV at a glance, I said that now we're operating at 80 to 90% of cost sharing. So that means that 80, 90% of the cost of the verification is paid by our collaborators or the vendors. So the vendors do pay a substantial amount for the verification. We wish it was less. In our earlier years, we had significant funding from EPA, and now we have much less funding from EPA. So we try and bring collaborators to the table who have the money. An example is we're going to be doing a solar thermal verification, and DOD is funding a good part of that.
So to answer your, I think, further, you'd call it, somebody who had something and wanted verified would call up Teresa
right.
And say, I have this technology. I happen to know I have a couple of competitors. Can I get this verified? And so that would launch an effort to figure out what the stakeholders think needs to be known about that technology. For example, if you had something that took arsenic, back to my exam, mercury out of drinking water from 25 down to 5, and you think that's the cat's pajamas, then we would ask stakeholders like public health departments and others to say, what do you need to know about a technology that claims to do that? And that would cause the development of this protocol. That wouldn't happen until the money was worked out. And then if there were five vendors of that, then the ETV program would try and broker among the vendors, maybe a municipality or two that wanted the technology to fund, come together with a funding package to finance that. So I don't know, Maggie, if you have...
Well, very well explained. I'd say, well, excellent explanation. The technology vendor, like yourself, might, Jeff, yep. I believe, asked the question, would contact, say, if it was a drinking water technology, the Drinking Water Center. The contact information is on the website, and tell them about the type of technology you're developing and say it's something to remove mercury. Then in that case, you know, he may already be aware of an effort with collaborators to verify technologies for that. And, you know, if there's an effort or if that's a topic that's already been identified, then we're farther along the road. If it's something that hasn't been identified, then he would take it to the stakeholders and ask if they're interested in verifying that.
Technology, I'm trying to guess, I know one on air monitoring that we've been discussing getting verified was in the, it was one vendor and the protocol, and I think we were in the $60,000 to $80,000 range. So that's the amount of money that has to be raised. I mean, that isn't multiple vendors splitting it, although if there are multiple and there are more tests, it might be larger. So this is not a $500,000 program necessarily, but it does have to cover the partners' costs. You saw the list of Parag Patel and NSF and others to develop protocol and convene the stakeholders.
And that cost obviously varies. If you have a monitoring technologies are usually less expensive to verify than something like a greenhouse gas technology. Right now we're going to be doing an assessment of gasification technologies for wastewater treatment sludge and for also paper and pulp sludge. The cost of that verification would be significant. So we're first doing an assessment of what's out there in terms of technologies and what the state of the technology is, and then looking at who can be the collaborators who can help bring the money to the table to lower the cost of the vendors.
So we try and be a convener, but that's...
Right, and we're very good at being a convener. This is how ETV has been able to survive. Despite major cuts to our budget over the last few years, we're now leveraging it at, 80% to 90%, which is very impressive. But it takes a while to bring the collaborators to the table. We have a number of them that are very appreciative of our efforts. As I listed off earlier, they range from DOD to the water utilities to states to NYSERDA. It really depends on U.S. Coast Guard. It depends on what the topic is.
I'll throw in the room. Yes, ma'am. I'm going to go to the phone after this lady here, Howard. Oh, sorry. I didn't see this hand. We got two in the room. My apologies, sir.
Hi, Ed Chris from RMT. I had a question about financing. You talk about financing and making decisions. Who's financing and how much are they financing in today's market?
Did I say financing, or did Maggie?
Maggie.
Well, I said that financiers were interested in our verifications, in that it's something that we've found that financiers and insurance institutions, financial institutions and insurance institutions are interested in the verifications. We've spoken with I've spoken with people who fund later stage venture capital, and for businesses that are beyond the early stages and are in the later stage where they have commercial ready technologies, they're ready to get them into the marketplace. Having a verification, they've felt really helps to give them confidence in the technologies. In some cases there may be people who are financing those companies who are for the later stage who would be interested in helping with the verifications, depending upon obviously what the topic is.
When you get the letter for this meeting, I mentioned we had a meeting like this with venture capitalists and angels, and one of the venture capitalists at the last meeting said his most important product from EPA was the verification report and the protocol that was used to figure out the costs of operating that technology, because it helped him benchmark
what is the real deal with that technology versus whatever else he was looking at. So that's my example of somebody who's in financing technologies interested in this program. Yes, ma'am.
Any other questions?
Hi. Yes, Pat Finnegan, development consultant. I imagine the time frame for getting this work done varies quite a bit depending on what area you're looking at, but can you give us some kind of a feel of what kind of turnaround might be on average from the time somebody comes to you till the time they get their verification completed?
Well, I would say it could be anywhere from a year to 2 years, depending upon if you call up and you have something that we are in the process of setting up a verification for, and we've already brought the collaborators to the table, then you know, it would be under a year. You know, and depending upon how many, you know, what kind of testing it requires. I think one of the longest ones I came across was actually one for Stormwater Technologies where they had to go through 13 major wet weather events. Now that, you know, that was on the very, you know, lengthy side for a verification. Whereas monitoring technologies, it's a lot faster. We're going to be doing verifications of lead paint test kits later this year and into early next year, and we hope to have all the reports done by the testing, the period for the applications just closed at the end of September. The reports are due by the spring, and then the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics is going to be reviewing those reports and recommending test kits based on that basis, and that's going to happen by June. So that's very quick. But that's been something that's been in progress, and we have had the funding for it, and that's set up. So it really depends on what the technology, you know, what category it is in, and where it comes into the process of making the verification happen.
And as you've said, obviously it matters. Treatment technologies where you have to have a whole structure and infrastructure versus monitoring go a lot faster. I'm going to cut off questions because we need to move on. And here in the room with us, we have Alan Waltz, who's the Director of Office Enforcement and Compliance Assurance here in Region 5. And he's going to be talking about one of my favorites in terms of secret weapon to help technology developers get their technologies tried out for the first time on the property of a one of our violators. And Alan will tell you more about that. Is it working?
Is this working?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all. I'll keep this brief as we're already over, but I just want to, at the beginning, Walt talked about how our core work is sort of the regulatory enforcement. So this is to provide an example of how within that core work there are some opportunities to promote technology innovation. Take the first slide. SEPs stands for Supplemental Environmental Projects. They're enforcement actions, a way for enforcement actions to demonstrate new technologies potentially. There's a SEP policy. I give you the website to find it, but essentially it identifies the requirement that there be a connection between the violation and the supplemental environmental project that's being proposed. That has some kind of environmental or health benefit for the area of the population that was affected, or provide a means of preventing further violations of the same kind. These SEPs are documented in settlement agreements, which are public documents. Many states also have SEP policies, and the requirements differ. They may be more flexible under some state SEP policies, so you're well advised to look at the state SEP policies if it's something you're interested in. Next slide. Give you a sense of the magnitude of this opportunity. There are about $30 million worth of SEPs in 07 and $39 million in 08. It's a less predictable set of funds than the other ones that we've been talking about because they're not specifically earmarked for technology innovation or promoting new technologies, but that does give you a sense of the pool of money that's out there. Some relevant categories for what we're talking about today, pollution reduction, pollution prevention, and environmental compliance promotion SEPs are all favored. and encouraged. And by the word encouraged, I mean that EPA can advise the facility that this is an opportunity for them, but we cannot require this as part of settlement. The facility feels they would rather just pay the money and go home. They have that option. But the reason that we present this as an opportunity is it provides us a way to provide direct environmental benefits. And it's also a way for a company that is essentially trying to comply and has fallen out of compliance to demonstrate its good faith and to demonstrate its focus on continuing its environmental, you know, continuing to improve its environmental performance. Next slide. In terms of the market, how do you identify where there's an opportunity that you might be able to play in? There's a couple of areas that I want to suggest. One is that if you go to the website for our STEP program, there's a project idea bank, so you can submit project ideas through there. You can also submit project ideas directly to me, and I'll share them with our enforcement programs in the region if you're interested in doing work within Region 5. Then also, if you want to get a sense of what the national and regional enforcement priorities are, the website I give you there is a good place to figure out what sectors EPA is really focused on, and I'll give you some idea of where our enforcement activities are likely to focus. Let's move on. I'm trying to keep this very short. And then lastly, I give you some examples of innovative technology steps that we've had in the past. Green building practices, a lot of green engineering opportunities, sustainable water infrastructure, carbon capture and sequestration, and so on. A lot of the same topic areas that you see highlighted in the programs we talked about today. And I also want to highlight that in the past, there were some steps that were considered innovative, but through the STEP program in part are kind of routine to this point, such as diesel retrofits and wood stove buybacks, which help promote better wood stove technology, and some items like that. So it's not, I would not call it a big technology forcer, but given that's where EPA's core mission is, I think it's important to kind of look at that as an area of opportunity. And I'll stop there so we have some time for questions.
I use this example to translate enforcement talk into technology talk. Alan usually says it's okay, which is, so I'm a violator and I have a power plant, let me say, on my property, and I've had violations of the Clean Air Act because of mercury emissions, and I'm going to have to write a check to Alan for $120,000 that goes to the Treasury as part of my violation, and you have a continuous emission monitor for mercury that would let me know that I'd never violate again if I were able to put that on rather than the occasional monitoring that I do. With Alan's, the lawyers present in the room, I could work with you. You would come to me and say, let's try my technology out, and I could write you a check for up to three quarters of the settlement, as I recall, in order to try out your technology as an alternative to what I'm currently doing. It isn't required to work. It just means I made a best effort. I still have to comply. Alan will be back next year at my power plant checking me out. But if it does work and I prefer it, then you've sold the equipment, I've had a demonstration, and the environment's better off. So that's the dynamic here. It's finding the place where the technology you have fits. That's why Alan was showing you where our targets are and so forth. So it isn't the way that we introduce, and the bank is a place that we refer. If I have the violating power plant, I could look on the bank and see if there are any ideas there that I might want to offer up to EPA. So there's our first question right there. I'll let you use that mic, Alan. Go ahead.
This is Joe Zlotnicki. Does the work you're doing under this SCP have to be in the same area? If you take your mercury example, could it be something, the CO2 or something else that wasn't subject to that violation? Or does it have to be in the specific topic area where you've got an enforcement going on?
It does not have to be in the same topic area. It does have to be addressing environmental and health needs in the same vicinity that was potentially affected by the violation. It does not necessarily have to be the same pollutants, however.
That mic failing? Okay. Other folks in the room? Over here. On the third table. Anybody on the phone? One in the back of the room there. We'll go ahead and shout it out. I'll repeat it.
So, say for example, we're developing.
You need to get that mic turned off in front of you.
Yeah. We're developing water treatment technology. We're working with the mining companies who work with the process water. Now, imagine most of my
But the question was about water treatment technology for mining companies. He thinks maybe there are violations by mining companies, and is this an opportunity?
Yes. Yes, this is a good example.
Yeah, that's a very good example. So if you know that there's a potential for violations, you might want to go ahead and identify that project as one that they can keep in their pocket should there be a violation in the future.
So you're marketing
so
to them.
It's a way to encourage them to start developing that technology so that they've got something that's ready to go should that occur.
You said they can use up to 75% of
the farms? It's 80%, but that's, And the mitigation ratio has to do with how beneficial the project is and some other criteria that are laid out in the SEP policy.
So it's up to 80%, not 80% every time, but always the fine print, right? On the phone? All right, any more in the room?
Oh, Walt, it's Maggie. I have a question.
Okay.
So thinking back to your mercury and water example, possibly there could be an ETV verification that could be part of a SEP because the SEP funding could go to the ETV partner to do the verification.
I think that's certainly a viable option.
So the idea was you could do a verification as a step in their acceptance of the technology. Gentlemen in the room here, and then we're going to move to a 5-minute break. So go ahead. I'll repeat it.
Okay, I'm Steve
Gans
from
Argo. Oh, hi, Steve.
It would depend on the violation. This is a list of some SEP ideas that have been written down by OECA, the office and headquarters, and they explicitly say that they have not tried to identify the nexus on these. So in somebody's mind, somewhere putting this down, they saw a potential violation where there would be a nexus. I don't know what that would be in this case. Well, again, the pollutant would not necessarily have to be a pollutant that was directly regulated or that was, you know, the subject of the violation. As long as there is a measurable environmental improvement or measurable health improvement, it would be allowable whether or not that particular pollutant
was
regulated.
Could be a SOX-NOX violation and do this as, I mean, that's what the person who wrote that down speculating about.
Right. Or even an emerging pollutant, some area that we're not regulating at all yet.
Okay, we're going to take a 5-minute break, an 8-minute break on my watch. That means we're going to start in 8 minutes on your watch, and we'll be back on the phone and online here to go through our main course of the meeting. We'll be back on in just a couple of minutes.
Test, 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 test. I tightened something. It might have worked. Does it sound better?
It was the feedback.
Well, feedback, but it was also, it was flashing. So I wonder if I fixed it when I tightened it.
They're going to be looking for ways to show that,
not really working
Care.
Everybody, for being prompt, we're going to start now and get back to the slides. And I'll get my. We're on the screen. We're going to come back to talking about slides related to technology needs. soon as I get my get the right slide up here, we'll be ready to go. So we're on the agenda now, teeing off the two main courses, as I said earlier, which is I have a couple of slides that you're looking at on what's in these needs packages that you have. And those of you in the room, you have a, and on the phone, you have a black printed kind of heavier stock set of needs that we've developed. You have an individual insert that was a late arrival relating to ballast technologies, and you also have some needs that were used by Region 6 EPA in a meeting they had with technology investors in February. Those are the main ones that I'm going to start the discussion with. What you have in our booklet with the light bulb on it is a polling that we did of our program offices here in our Regional Science and Technology Council, and tried to get a sense of the problems that they see either in their role as operating our air, water, and waste programs or enforcement or other things that they come across in their work. So the Midwest Perspective document that you have, the black covered book, is organized in three areas: things that are near commercial ready that we are aware of, and those dots connect directly to, in general, the ETV program. You'll see that some of those technology needs are in the process of being developed, and in fact the contact information, almost all of those are either 513 area codes or 919, because those are the two labs that are working on verification of those near commercial ready technologies. Also in the booklet you have a list of needs that we see for mitigation and treatment and remediation, and on the back page a list related to monitoring, measurement, and sampling technologies. So overall there's about 22 different needs that we've seen in our work looking across the region. The second document that you have is a plain Word document that's called Thematic Categories of Environmental Issues, and that was developed by our EPA Region 6 office. They took a more thematic approach. Some of their needs are more generally worded than the specific ones that are in our black covered book. And as I said, lastly, you have an insert of a one paragraph need related to ballast water technologies. So to go back to the slide, you also have received a listing of needs. We went across the street to our friends at the General Service Administration. We're talking to them about this meeting and the meeting with the investors in this meeting, and they developed about half a dozen or more needs that have to do with their operation of the portfolio of federal buildings in this region. They have to do with everything from new skin for the building to gather energy to what to do with the food waste from the cafeterias in federal buildings across the region. So the names and contact information for those needs are also on their list. So you have a collection, basically, of different kinds of, some from GSA that are also environmental in the sense that they have to do with energy conservation or reducing their footprint of their buildings. But ours, of course, have to do, whether it's from Region 6 or from here in Region 5, with our main mission that I spent early on in the program. So that, if you go back to the slide, I think that's what I had on there. And our issues here, and I think I'm going to do, we found that this works better if I just keep pressing on, and then I'll ask our speakers to come up, Alan and Kathy and Jeff, in a minute. But the questions we want you to think about and respond to are, should we be doing this? Is it worth our efforts to go out? And we've posted these needs now on a website we have here in Region 5. And if we should do this, if we should be articulating needs, which is what the advisory committee suggested that we do, how should we do that? This kind of a meeting is certainly one medium. Posting things on websites means people have to be looking for them, which is always, in my mind, not the most efficient thing, because you're all busy and we're busy. And listservs, webinars, occasional gatherings, just giving speeches at other environmental events. I mean, there are a variety of ways to do this, but the point is this triggering for you any response that would make it worth our while to do this, and on what frequency? So those are the kind of things I'm going to ask Alan and Kathy and Beth in a minute to talk about regarding the needs, and they don't have to answer all those questions. They're, as I say, they say what they want to say. I'm going to go on to the next slide and cover it at the same time. Oh, on to regs, right? And we have, as I mentioned jokingly earlier, EPA, I'm on the slide that says technology perspectives from the EPA regs, so this is the second subject of this meeting. The document I mentioned jokingly earlier has 150 pages. It comes out twice a year, and it basically is an elaborate listing of all the regulations that EPA is either considering the subject matter. We don't even have a schedule. It also lists, as you see in the third bullet, final and completed rules, and it lists rules that are proposed. And so what we've done is taken about 14 regulations out of that 150-page list, which has about 280 entries in it, and collapse them down to actually this digest that you have in your packet and also available when sent in advance, and basically taken by media, air, water, and waste, hazardous waste, and put a paragraph in about how we think that regulation might drive a technology need. So, again, this is not so much looking at problems that we found in the regions or enforcement or other kinds of work that we do. This is looking ahead. Again, this was in the advisory committee report, that is there a way for EPA to communicate what's coming down the road? Because obviously something that needs to be developed for a future reg needs time to develop, and our regulatory process can take anywhere from a couple of years to much longer, depending on what the subject is. Obviously, ranging from big-ticket subjects like greenhouse gases to smaller subjects like regulating of de-icing fluids at aircraft on airports, which just came out as a final rule in the last 2 months. So there's a whole range of things that are covered in proposed regulations, but they are, in our view, or in the view of the advisory committee, tips and so forth. Again, the same set of questions. We're interested in, should we bother? This took some effort to take the Reg Digest, which twice a year comes out, and if we should bother, what should we do with it? The fact that we've interpreted some needs, and who should get it, and how should we get it to them, and so forth. So with that introduction, Alan, can I get you to make your way up here, and Kathy, you'll be next, and then we'll hear from Jeff, and again, they're not scripted, so they have whatever they want to say, and then we'll go to the room and on the phone. So I'm going to give you mine. Why don't you go ahead and take this mic. If you'd like to sit. Jeff, do you want to come up here and sit? And then we'll go to Kathy as soon as. So this is Alan Dines from, again, President of Midwest Research University Network. So thanks for being here this morning, Alan. And
all right. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Walt. Appreciate the chance to be here. I first ask if everybody can hear me okay. This is actually working, the microphone and all that.
Yep. I think you're on.
Okay.
You have to be up a little higher on your
time. I would ask if you could turn up the volume. This is Jean. The speaker's coming through really faintly.
How's this now?
That's much better. Thank you.
All right. Great. Okay, thank you, Walt, and thanks, appreciate the opportunity to be here. I kind of am wearing two hats today. I'm Assistant Director of the Office of Corporate Relations at the UW-Madison, and I'm also President of EMRON. Let me just mention a little bit about the role I fill at the university. Corporate relations, our job is essentially to be the front door for business and industry to the university, so we kind of act as a facilitator to help companies access resources to the university, anything from hiring graduates, finding interns, help in global competency, technology transfer, sponsored research, faculty expertise, all those sorts of things we do. My job in particular is I work with new ventures and private equity, so we also have a very strong program in startups. Startups come out of research that our faculty are engaged in. We're actually a pretty large research institution, about number two in the country. In fact, if you look at all R&D funding across the full spectrum, science as well as humanities, business, arts, education. We also have about 40,000 students, many of whom are getting very interested in startups. So we kind of help move those folks ahead with whatever it takes to move them ahead. And again, we mainly work as a referral sort of organization. So we maybe connect them with people who have money, sometimes connect them with management talent, sometimes connect them with people who can help them in the business planning, the market assessment, and that sort of thing. Let me move on to Emron. What I do at the University of Wisconsin, I discovered there are several other major universities here in the Midwest that have much the same sort of management challenge in terms of getting their startups going. So Emron started up about 5 years ago as a really informal networking organization of the people at the major Midwest research universities who are engaged in facilitating tech transfer through startup companies. So we are, I should mention our website. There is an Emron website. It's Midwest Research University Network is the name of it. If you just use Google, you'll probably find it. But it's simpler to just remember emron.us, not org, not net, not com, but emron.us with the www in front. We represent, actually, the Midwest is about a quarter of the nation's R&D, funded R&D capacity, both from federal as well as foundation and industry sources. So the Midwest is very large in that respect. We have a number of institutions in the Midwest that are typically in the top 15 or 20 nationwide, institutions like University of Illinois, University of Michigan, University of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio State, Washington University. We also have, as participants and members of Emron, Argonne National Laboratories here in the Chicago area. We have the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic. So we represent a number of medical centers as well as universities. So with that kind of ground setting, maybe going to what do I think here about what I've heard, I think basically EPA is on the right track. I'm especially... I should mention I have a little bit more of a history with EPA than many people at the university. Before I joined the university, I had a company that operated in the bioremediation space, and before that I'd worked with a number of projects in the biotechnology and agriculture space, and before that even was at a consulting firm in Washington where I think we worked with some of the early clean air policy development things. I think they called it the bubble policy back in those days, but it was the early version of emission rights trading. So I think what I've heard here is that there are some very exciting opportunities as we move into a world of increasing the quality of environmental controls and the attention we devote to clean tech. Even apart from that, there's a whole world of emerging technology that is giving us a new option to do things that we wanted to do before in a wholly different way. Universities are basically generators of a lot of ideas, so it's a natural that the new technologies coming out of universities could have some application. Part of the reason we focus on startups is that it's not enough to just have a cool idea, a great technology. You've really got to have a driven entrepreneur. You have to have somebody who really is willing to push and claw through all the conventional reasons not to do something that wants to do it. You also need to have money. So I think as you come to I think Walt mentioned that EPA is regulation-driven and tends to look at things through that lens. I think you have to recognize universities are fundamentally teaching and research-driven. And so we look through things like the lens of trying to expand the world of the envelope of knowledge, trying to solve world problems. And often our inventions are really side products of that effort to expand the envelope of knowledge. And so university tech transfer offices have long been saddled with this task of trying to figure out where to find licensees for these random acts of invention. In that regard, I found the papers, perspectives on regulation, the ideas of where some of the new directions and regulations could stimulate new markets, I found it very interesting. I think entrepreneurs are people who, by their nature, are very inquisitive and they're very thorough. They will ferret out this sort of stuff, but it never hurts to have the information more available in a simple, simple form, in a broadcast form, websites, listservs, emails, meetings, all of those are useful techniques. We do a lot of this on campus, and we're only struggling to get, out of 40,000 students, we're lucky if we can get 100 of them at a given meeting on a topic that we think is pretty exciting. So I think, you know, it's something that things don't happen overnight. People learn about these things a bit or two at a time, and I think, as I say, you're on the right track with this, and I'd like to see more of these sorts of efforts. At MRUN, we're experimenting with other ways to let people know what's going on. We've tried email. We've got the website. We try a little bit of just personal communication. Our latest venture is with Twitter. So you can now go to our Twitter feed, MRUN Hotline, and we'll be experimenting with that as a way to kind of stimulate the conversation about what's going on in the region with respect to startups and high tech. So I'll stop there.
So I have to figure out a way to do it in 140 characters, is what you're telling me. Kathy Banks, we're ready to turn to you. As you see, she is the professor of civil engineering, and as I mentioned earlier, a practitioner of new technologies and developer. Would you like to make some comments?
Yes, thanks all for asking me to participate. I'm going to come at it from a little different perspective because, as we talked about earlier, you wanted a perspective as a faculty member. And I will point out that often the faculty members, particularly the newer faculty members, are focused more on basic research than applied research. However, I do believe there's a new interest in entrepreneurship, particularly for the many of the younger faculty, and I think that it's certainly important these efforts are communicated to them. With regard to the questions you posed about the brochure and the linking the regulatory agenda to the technology development aspects, certainly I think both are wonderful, and I think the outreach for both of those will be important. I do believe that this should be open information. I think any way to get the information out, whether it be web, word of mouth, conferences, et cetera, would certainly help the cause. I do believe, though, it will be a question for faculty members or researchers as to how to fund these types of efforts. I feel, and I noted your explanation of how recent basic research moves to application, the figure that you have, I believe that there should be more feedback loops into both the STAR program and SBIR. Let me mention the reason I think that is that often the questions that you have and your offices have with regard to new technologies, the solutions are supported by basic research. And when I've reviewed SBIR proposals, I will say that what I've noted is that there is often a lack of that foundation in the proposals themselves. So I think that perhaps a clear path of a feedback loop to basic research would help researchers understand not only that the information moves toward technology development, but also technology development or application of technology in the field often leads to more basic research questions that should be answered. I will say that you mentioned something interesting, I felt, with regard to the use of consultants to set regulatory levels. It may be interesting for you to also think about using consultants to gather basic information about an application. If companies or investors would like to have to understand more about what's out there in the basic research area in literature, for example, or conference proceedings, that might help jumpstart the process. Of course, IP agreements and the whole IP process is somewhat vague to younger faculty, but I think all universities, including Purdue, are moving forward to address that. I do believe that face-to-face contact is important as well. I like the idea of invited workshops where you do bring the experts in the field, not only from the academic side, but investors and industry, to a table, locker room, and, and ask them to prepare a white paper on a specific topic. I do like the ETV example of how to bring interested parties to the table to test new technologies. I think that perhaps that could be modified somewhat to include those basic researchers in those efforts. The issue that you may face is I do believe you have a number of very strong research labs in EPA for the more traditional areas. The questions or the challenges will be when you move into areas that perhaps the scientists at your labs don't have the background to address. And I think that EP program, SEP program, is a wonderful program to try and jumpstart some ideas and some at least conversation about research and technology development. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. I've got a mic that works now. Okay, we're going to go on to, I'm teeing this up for those of you in the room and on the phone elsewhere to make other comments, or Alan and Kathy can say something more too, but we're going to go to Jeff now and get his reaction to both the list of needs and the Regit digest.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Walt. My name is Jeff Pearl. I'm president of Chicago Chem Consultants. This is a small boutique type chemical and environmental engineering consulting firm for the last 20 years, located walking distance from here actually today. I'm a chemical engineer, worked on probably all aspects of environmental technology development and review over the last 20 plus years, both in government, academia, and in industry. I want to answer one question someone asked earlier about the Congress and what kind of input that they have. I worked about 20 years ago with the Office of Technology Assessment on the then review for the 1990 Superfund reauthorization, which didn't happen exactly at that time, but Congress, for some reason, chose to remove that organization. The Office of Technology Assessment used to be the group that helped advise Congress. So I'm glad that we have forums like this to pick up the slack there, but it's unfortunate that doesn't exist, and perhaps someone will suggest it to their congressman. I want to just some general comments going through here. This is sort of stream of consciousness. As those of you who know me know, this is how I work. I take ideas in and I kind of push them out. I go into a zone, and whatever comes out. Sometimes my clients are actually happy. Regulatory development needs. I've seen this both on the inside of the United States Air Force, where I work with was assigned to the Air Force Center for Environmental Excellence and the Air Education Training Command for over 10 years, working on remediation as well as compliance issues. Things like definitions of listed and characteristic wastes that still hobble remedial actions around the country that I stumble on them as well in an industrial sense. Some better definition probably needs to be had, and I think while you're working on these, you have a real good opportunity actually in some of these programs that you've got put here in the brochure. Municipal solid waste to energy is huge. We've had a number of venture capitalists or just companies come to us over the last 7 or 8 years in particular. We're running out of landfill space. That often isn't seen as a driver necessarily. I certainly saw it getting into the business about 22 years ago. So this is huge, and I think it's to be applauded that you're focusing on this. Water resource management is another tremendous issue that is not always in the forefront here in the Great Lakes, because we have plenty of it, or we think we do, but it is in the country. Combined heat and power, both in the manufacturing sector, the environmental sector. We've worked in both these areas. I actually had the opportunity to work on this a little bit with the Air Force. Military is actually very interested in conserving energy, believe it or not. This is another big area. Must be bottom line oriented. I can tell you as a consulting engineer, that's why our clients come to us. They want us to help vet the process for them, sometimes design the process for them, review this, whether it's a new process or a revamps. I like the Environmental Technology Verification Program. For years, I've been directing people to the SITES program, the Superfund Innovative Technology Assessment Program, because of its tremendous amount of basically free information that's available. The ETV, I think, is another good one. I learned about this through the, again, through the military over 10 years ago. It's a good program. I think it needs to be plussed up a little bit. That's why I asked my question earlier about where financing. To make it a little clearer to people how they can get these, how they can leverage different types of financing. Venture capitalists, a little bit on venture capitalists. Don't be a do-it-yourselfer. Watch the do-it-yourselfers. We get a lot of them coming through our doors, whether it's for new technology or even projects they're trying to do. My favorite example is the farmer. I'm in love with the American farmer. The American farmer gives us all food that we eat. The farmer is someone who can do everything himself or herself, and they love to do it. They don't care how long it takes to get it done, but they're going to do it. And we run across a lot of farmers. I call them lovingly in my business because they want to try and grab an idea, see if they can do it themselves, and 5 years later, and so many millions of dollars, you know the story. Time is money. I'm always a proponent of hiring competent engineers and scientists or universities to help you weed through some of these issues. Again, the ETV, I think, can serve as a good neutral arbitrator, as Walt mentioned that. I like that almost as a mediator. You have to have somebody in the room, particularly with the venture capitalists. And we've seen some pretty interesting characters come off of almost out of central casting from Hollywood with ideas that they've had. And they don't want – it's very difficult when there's no trust and there's no competency on the part of the lenders. In terms of how do you get the word out, part of it, obviously, you keep doing things like this. Should we be doing this? Is an absolute yes. I think that that's very clear. It's a very the fact that EPA doesn't have that much money compared to some of the other agencies, to me, is all the more impressive that they're able to get the word out with such low, a much lower or reduced level of financing. How to get the word out? One of my favorite types is through professional organizations. American Institute of Chemical Engineers is near and dear to my heart. I'm very much involved with that, both locally and nationally. For over 7 years, I also helped bring some of the R&D needs for Army, Air Force, Navy to AICHE, so I know how effective this is. It's a great way to get the word out. In fact, some of my colleagues here in the room will be in Nashville with 4,000 of our closest friends in a couple of weeks at the AICHE annual meeting, where programs like this are often put forward, and that's a great place to put these ideas out, because these good people, and I'm now part of the system, I'm actually adjunct at the University of Illinois here at Chicago teaching chemical engineering design, they're always looking for new avenues, new ways to use their own research, and no better way than, I think, to use some of the professional societies as forums. Let's see if there was anything else I want to say. Walt, how are we doing on time?
I think we could, if you want to stop, we can, and then we'll come back to you all if there are other...
What happened to me? Here we go. Why don't we stop there, if you want, and then that doesn't mean you and Alan and Kath can't say more, but I wanted to keep to my contract with the people in the room as well. So I'm taking other comments. I'll go to the phone in just a minute if anyone there in the room. And there's the first one. I'll repeat it. We've got all the mics tied up here, so I'll have to. Or Howard, why don't you take this mic from me, and then we'll pass this other one around.
All right. But they can't hear you on the phone.
Hi there. Yeah, this is Steve Wilkins. I'm in business development. I would reverse the question. What are the negatives of you know, communicating these needs? I don't see any at all. To me, it's a very interesting list, and bulbs are starting to go off. So I think nothing bad can come from this. So I would encourage it very much, and keep doing these types of.
Well, I guess the trade-off for us is that instead of doing this, we could be having individual meetings going out. I mean, it has to do with the expenditure of time. We don't have, you know, unlimited time. And so, in some ways, having this meeting and this concept is like throwing a pebble in the stream, and then are we going to see what results? I don't expect that to happen to this month, this year, but how much of an investment should we make in continually updating the reg agenda and continually updating the needs? One measure we have is if anybody calls back, right? If anyone calls anyone on this list, that's why we put all the names and phone numbers, that's a measure. And or if anyone calls the people listed under the regulations, we've chatted with them and what they wrote, what the technology need might be. So, but that would be our only feedback. We won't know, you know, for 3 or 4 years whether some technology gets developed. On the other hand, several of you cornered Alan while we were on the break, so I know there's already needs or using some of these vehicles has had some use in this meeting. So, but it's a trade-off for us on how to spend the outreach time. Other
things to throw in on that, I think Jeff mentioned it too, the idea of leveraging these sorts of information dispersal events with other professional societies. Another one that would be a real good one is AUTUMN, the Association of University Technology Managers. There are a variety of venture capital conferences held around the region, around the country, and again, you don't necessarily have to become a sponsor of those sorts of things, but having somebody attend one every now and then and have some kind of visibility in those is a good way to connect with the companies.
Right, piggybacking, good. We have 3 more in the room here, and then I'm going to switch to the phone, I guess.
Hi, I'm Rob Foster with Colinco Consulting. Formerly worked with the SITE program, NORD, and know that program for many years as a positive benefit. One of the things you said earlier, Walt, was that there's really no comprehensive monitoring of technology developments for certain areas, and I guess that might be something that would be a good way to spend some money. It seems like that's happening in pockets at different areas, whether it's indirectly through ETV or through creative programs or the like. But some kind of coalescing of that, I think, would be a benefit to the community. Your thoughts?
Okay. Somebody has to make that investment is my only reaction to that, but that requires a budget. Okay.
Yeah, this is Bob Patrick. If I'm being naive, I apologize, especially for the EPA people. But this is a question for all 4 of them, and mainly Alan. I used to work for the Salk Institute with technology transfer. And one of the problems that we had with keeping the researchers within CIBIA, which was the Salk Institute Biotechnology Associates, on message. And I don't know whether that's something that the EPA can do or that you've had better experience with, Alan, but we researchers would get started there, and we would take off into an entirely new direction and lose complete sight where we were supposed to be going. And is that the kind of work that the EPA is doing? How successful are they? I'm just speaking as an individual who had a lack of success at doing that.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I think we're into lenses here today, it seems. So the lens that the faculty think about when they consider doing research is fundamentally, what is it going to do for my tenure? What is it going to do for published papers? So when they get off track, it's not necessarily off track with respect to their major objectives in life, which are as university researchers. So the trick, and again, this is why a lot of tech transfer offices look at what they do is licensing random acts of invention. In contrast, you look at industry where, you know, the R&D funding in industry is specifically directed to strategic objectives of the organization. So I think that the good news is that actually a lot of what researchers are doing does have fallout or does have relevance to a lot of the things that EPA is expressing as needs. Clean tech is a really hot topic now. And venture capital is even looking at clean tech as a significant area for investment, which is a really good piece. The fundamental thing that drives the entrepreneurs in a technology company, they fundamentally don't have products immediately. They have to develop them, and that means they're fundamentally at the mercy of the capital market. So financial strategy basically drives their business strategy. So again, the front end availability of some of these market drivers from regulation is important and compelling, but when you get to the investor, they're usually driven by something like, how soon am I going to get my money back, and how much more of it am I going to get than I put in? And there's a whole bunch of risk factors associated with time and the practicality of the invention, all that sort of thing. So it's a tough one. But I think we can keep working on it.
We're going to go to the next question here in the room, but just to answer your question, as far as being wired into EPA research, I mean, we're not necessarily wired into the country's research. I mean, I'm going to a meeting tomorrow, actually, in D.C., where we're discussing this very issue, is how do we make sure that whether we're doing it in-house or if it's sponsored research. Kathy Banks mentioned STARS, the Science to Achieve Results, is our academic research sponsored program. How do we make sure that those folks working on those subjects connect back in with the people who helped write this list? I'm holding up the black covered light bulb right now, and that's a continuing challenge for us. Because once they launch, then we hear back in 2 years or 3 years, of course, if there's a peer-reviewed paper, back to the motivations. But that's one of our challenges. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm Amar from UOP. So from an industry perspective on this, I wonder if it makes much more tactical sense to go along verticals. So you pick a target area, assemble all the ETBs and the SCPs around those, the regs that are coming out, and then you will draw the folks who are really interested in committing right away. Right? So pick a target area, and EPA could organize in a venue like this. You'd have the program managers present and talk about it. And so it ties the industry and academia, and whoever wants to get in, tells them what the vehicles there are and what the current interest is. So any comments on that?
The mic was breaking up a little bit. What I heard you say is that we pick a target area, I guess, meaning smaller number than the number in this book, and then try and gather people around a couple of those who are developers. I guess Kathy and Alan would say the researchers in that area, and say, this is what we need. But I find, just as a reaction to that, organizing a meeting like that and not being able to serve dinner, which is the funding for it, is going to cut down on the attendance, just to be a little biased. That means April's at the meeting, and she can say you can apply for the SBIR program and the one at NSF, which has $175 million. But the CHIPS still, I mean, we don't run a directed research program here, right? We cannot run a non-competitive one. So I'm trying to operate in my world versus in UOP. You can bring together, you can find the best researchers, fly them in, have a meeting, say we need a new catalyst and we need it next year. What are you going to do for me? It's a much different dynamic.
Right. What I heard was the ETVs and the SCPs talk about specific needs you have today.
Those are options, right? Those are options. Those are not things that those programs need. Those are just ideas that have been suggested, the steps and the ETVs. Right. On the phone, can I just try somebody on the phone besides, in addition to Kathy? Anyone else?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, my name's Adrienne Mell. I'm a new AAAS fellow in the Office of the Science Advisor. So what about working directly in these technology incubators? Like, has there been any past experience in how EPA has actually functioned in one of these incubators?
Functioned in?
I mean, what sort of associations, you know, has EPA been able to make in the past, or is that sort of an area that they've never gone into?
Well, I think as far as just on the issue of becoming familiar with technology incubators, I mean, we've had some encounters over the years with individuals and others, associations. There's an association of the technology incubator organizations in the country, which EPA has at least put up their directory and has been involved. But as far as going directly to one and talking about, I mean, they are, one of our problems being a regulator and not a, enabler entirely is we don't pick winners. We don't pick winners among grantees. We don't pick winners among nonprofits. We don't pick winners among corporations. So it's, we can lift all boats and put out a message to the Association of Incubators or all the ones in our region, but if I'm understanding your question, we don't develop an arrangement with anybody just because they happen to be in Illinois or they happen to be in Minnesota. That's not what we do. Does that help, or were you driving at something else?
No, it was just sort of a general question.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Jeff, you wanted to say
something? Walt, it's Maggie.
Wait, Maggie, I got Jeff's going to say something in just a minute. I want to hear from the non-EPA people if I can.
Yes. I think with the light bulb brochure that everybody has, what you're looking at here really is a wonderful fodder for an all-day session at one of the professional societies like AICHE or ACS. What we did with the military for about 7 years is we brought in the military R&D needs that were applicable to chemical engineers at AICHE. We had sort of a three-ring circus. One, we would present something like this brochure, but in almost a paper format, you know, just a presentation for the needs. Secondly, we would have at the request of one of our university colleagues, he said, you know, we really don't know how to approach the military. So we did a funding 101 program that explained to them how the funding process worked. Now, I think for EPA, I would say it's not so much how that works because many people work with EPA, but these disparate aspects of funding that can be tied together, that's not clear. And then the third leg of this thing was a very successful poster session where all these posters and you've got, gosh, over about a dozen different EPA program managers would be there to talk their program and start discussing these things. So this is a ready-to-go prepackaged program here that you can take not just to AICHE but other organizations. ACS is four times larger than we are, for instance, and they have industrial. And the other thing, one last thing I would say is that someone mentioned had a question. We've been bumping up against this. I'll state the question while I'm answering it for years, and that is the difference between science and engineering. Yeah, I bumped up against this when I first showed up at the Air Force Center for Environmental Excellence about 15 years ago, and everything in Superfund was still being studied. Science, everything, it was great stuff, but when they went over to transitioning, the engineering portion of it was not lost, but I think my science friends didn't want to give it up, maybe, or from a program perspective. And so I would say, emphasize the fact that part of what EPA is doing here is bridging the good science with the good, and engineering, by the way, is not just risk protection, but it's cost effectiveness. And that bottom line cost effectiveness is very important to the venture capitalists. That's it.
Okay, Maggie, and then I want to go back in the room here.
Just to say that on the incubator topic, I worked with an incubator when I was the Region 1 regional technology advocate. I worked with an incubator in Maine that focused on environmental technologies. And it was a very, I would say, effective in terms of my time, very time efficient way to go in and meet with them because they would bring in people not only who were directly at the incubator, but from the surrounding area. And I worked with them on funding issues, you know, verification options through the ETV program and other types of things relevant to their positions.
Okay. And while we take this question in the room, Kathy, I wanted to tee one up for you after this question in the room and ask you whether you thought this idea of instead of us holding the meeting and having you come here, we invade ASCE in your case or AICHE or ASME and go that route, whether that would be successful. Well, let me have you think about that while I take this question in the room.
I'm not sure if this is a question or a comment.
Comment,
but, the discussion that Jeff had about science and technology and the DOD sparked something that we've run into in the DOD and I think might be applicable here. With the tightening budgets nowadays, one of the things we found ourselves in a situation, we actually had a program funded, we were doing some early stage research, and then the program the target program died, and so we had to basically work within the agency to find a new vehicle which would then we could redirect to efforts. Yes, and I'm wondering if EPA will have some things like that going forward under the tight budgets with clean tech. You know, all of a sudden you're over here looking at arsenic, and for whatever reason, say arsenic goes away, can you reapply whatever you've been doing your research to something else? It seems that there, I know in our experience in DOD, there's a lot of perhaps you call it vertical thinking, where the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing. And I think that really needs to be avoided, particularly in a tight budget situation.
I have a smile on my face for those on the phone. That never happens at EPA. One of our problems, just to comment on that, was we keep coming upon problems we think are finished, like how to do drinking water treatment. Now we've named in, the last month and a half, six new contaminants that we need to worry about for new levels of drinking water standards. And so that program is off and running again on new contaminants that we hadn't thought about. So it seems as if we never give up in some media, including wastewater and water. But I guess your point is that if things can be adapted, they should. I don't predict we're going to have large funding, new funding programs at EPA. That would not be likely, just as a personal view. But this leveraging, the kind that April talked to you about, where we work with, in this case, NSF, and they're going to fund a lot of projects. So somebody who gets on that train has a great chance if they pass peer review, I think, is the kind of thing we should do with ag, and somebody mentioned that, and DOE and others. So, Kathy, could I get you to comment on the outreach approaches? My question?
Yes. Well, I want to make one more comment before I move to that.
Okay.
There was this discussion about keeping researchers...
I'm having trouble hearing. Can you get closer to your handset or something? It's just muffled here.
Okay, how about that? So I wanted to make a comment about the keeping researchers on track. I think that with regard to applications, I think the way that I've seen that work best is if there are partnerships developed early on with clear objectives and realizing that not all university researchers or even researchers in EPA, not all of them will be good and successful at application-driven research. But I feel that if you have a partnership with the user in some way, whether it be through EPA or industry, and continual feedback between the partner and the researcher, that you're more likely to have an end product that is acceptable to all. With regard to outreach at professional societies, certainly that's a good idea. In the environmental community on the civil engineering side or infrastructure side, we tend to have many different organizations that where we present, including AICG as well as AFCE. I believe that getting information out to those groups it would be important, but also I think it's important to bring the thought leaders together, and whether that be from industry or universities. I think a smaller group after the general information is given to all may be beneficial.
Okay, thank you. Who was I? Was someone else up in the room? Yes, sir. Yes, Dennis.
Dennis O'Brien with Jacobs Consultancy. And, of course, as Jeff knows, I think using the yearly symposium that we have been conducting for the last 4 years and perhaps setting up two of those sessions where we're asking not only AICHE, but perhaps probably chaired by EPA members, employees, where we have speakers come in and talk or address specific issues, and use that as a kind of a model for trying to put this incubator, this technology transfer, this, just bring all of this out in a regular recurring forum. Perhaps we could bring in ACS and any of the other organizations that might have an interest, depends upon the theme that's each session is brought up on. But some of the feedback that we had, that the university research that we tried this year worked out pretty well.
All right, thank you. Anybody else in the another voice back here? While we're moving the mic, anyone else on the phone wants to make a suggestion about keep doing this, stop doing this? Okay, we have another question or comment in the room then.
My perspective is, as an entrepreneur but also an angel investor, I don't think that anybody ever brings me ideas for new companies that matches any lists that I ever imagined. So I'm not big on people publishing lists. Mostly what they're coming to me for, sometimes money, but much more often advice, somebody that has expertise. So having access to, and I don't exactly know how you do this, but access to EPA experts or mentors, I think would be much more valuable to an entrepreneur than any funding you're going to put together, any list you're going to put out. I think that events like this, where people are in the room and you get to network a little bit and ask questions, I keep doing them, especially here in Chicago. This is not a, my experience, not a great place for entrepreneurs. I was pleasantly surprised to get an invitation to this meeting. So thank you.
I think the statistic in Illinois is we have a lot of patents issued in this state, and they all, none of them companies end up being funded here. So that's another problem that's not mine. But Jeff.
Yeah, it's just a real quick answer. I'm glad to that question. Some years ago, my company became an EPA Energy Star qualified consulting engineering firm. There is such a thing, and I maybe something could happen along the lines of, I don't know how you do it, but maybe a little more complicated than that. But is there any possibility that that could happen? I'm not sure how it would happen, but.
I'm sorry, have it? What is it?
Well, it meaning the equivalent, environmental engineering, if I could just refer to it that way, engineer list of people, competent people you could go to. EPA, we're listed on the EPA Energy Star website.
Oh, I see. So it's accreditation program.
Accreditation program, service providers. I'm not sure if that's something that would work.
Okay. Anybody else? Back to the front here again, and we're kind of up with our contract time, so we'll make this the next to last word. I'll do one more after this if we need it. So.
Yeah, I'll keep this short. Is there a plan to have a joint meeting between technology providers and the angel investors, or on your webpage, do you have a list of the people attended and some idea of what was covered in the meeting a week or 2 weeks ago?
This meeting was recorded, so the presentations were, and Sean's going to be on the Clue Insight, and we think we did that also for the investor meeting, so you could go listen to those two meetings. As to whether there's any marriage making going on after this, that kind of leaves my area of influence, but I can tell you that I did meet with the regional director for the Economic Development Administration, Federal Economic Development Administration here in Chicago, and he came to our last meeting, and he's told me that he's open to entities approaching him to bring up the subject of matchmaking. So I guess if there are interests in, that can be united between the venture capital or the few angels that were at our meeting or others and new technology developers, he's a guy, his name is Robert Sawyer, and he's willing to help sponsor such matchmaking, elevator, you know, a variety of names they use for those elevator meetings, beauty contests. We won't be doing that at EPA because, again, we don't pick winners, but we'd have to have some entity do that. So I'm hopeful that a few of those get held, actually. Ideally, selfishly, I'd love for them to be about problems we've identified, but nonetheless, if they further environmental technologies in the Midwest, that's a good thing, too. So, Alan, want to comment on that?
Yeah, specific on that point, coming up November 23 and 24 at the Chicago Federal Reserve is a meeting called Clean Tech 2009. There will be something on the order of 12 innovation companies, innovative young companies at that event. There will be angel and venture capital investors, and also a big component will be the international community. So that'll be right here in Chicago, November 23-24. The website is www.westcleantech2009.com. If you can say that in one breath. Or else see me afterward. I'll be happy to pass on some other information. But that's exactly focused on bringing together some of the investor types with some of the people with the ideas.
One last comment. Somebody on the phone? Okay, well, thank you for staying. Oh, one more over here, and then behind you, Howard. We got two. Okay, we'll do the last two. Steve.
Thank you, Steve Vance, Argon. Need new mic technology.
Right.
As a researcher and a research manager for my entire career, most of the time selling contracts, I would just comment that the hardest thing for a researcher to get at are the needs, the real needs of the market and of the regulators. And in particular, to publish those needs with the name of an individual you can contact to find out how flexible those needs are, really stimulates innovation from the sense of, I got a technology and I learn about a need, I can try to bend that technology to fit the need and solve a real problem. So I commend you for the publication and in particular, the names of people to talk to who, you know, can interpret what really is going to go down.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. This little gentleman over here, Howard, has the last way on the opposite side. Just to let you know, the invitees for this meeting of universities, we wrote to every vice president of tech transfer and intellectual property, whatever the title is, of all universities of over 15,000 in our region. So that was 60 universities plus, all right? Or some 15, less than 15,000. So it's a start. Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Stan Seelig. I'm with Waters Cleaning. It's my own company, so I'm an entrepreneur. I have also been a consultant. I am a consultant as well in the chemical industry and also as an industrial scientist. And I see a lot of academia here. I see consultants. I see some organization people here. I don't see enough, I think, industrial people. All right, I think it would have been a good idea if you probably got some more industrial people present here. So they might be able to see what projects the government is interested in. But otherwise, I think you're doing a great idea here. I also think that you should go out to the local national meetings and maybe some of those local section meetings, ACS, AICHE, American Oil Chemist Society, which is very big on biodiesel area. You know, there's a number of different areas that you can get out there, but I think you're lacking a little bit maybe on some of the industrial people.
Okay. Well, yes, it's a matter of who we can get to come, right, as well as how to invite them.
I found out by luck through emails from contacts that I've had
right
here.
Well, thank you very much for your time. We're over time, and we appreciate your being here. You have a lot of our names and phone numbers, so thanks for being here, and thanks for being on the phone. If those of you are on the web, there is an evaluation form, and if Gene doesn't say this, then we'd love for you to fill it out and get your feedback on how this worked for you. Thanks again, and have a good day.
Yes, thank you. As Walt mentioned, this is Jean Valley. I want to thank everyone for participating. If you do have just a few moments to follow through to the very final slide of the presentations today, that'll bring you back to the additional resources page where you'll be able to download today's materials in a variety of formats as well as a number of the other documents and websites that were referenced by our speakers.
Those of you who are here, you can get online and fill out an evaluation form if you'd like.
Yes, indeed. And at the very bottom of that page, you'll also see a link for a feedback form. It'll take just a minute or two. And if you do fill out that form, we would greatly appreciate it if you found today's session valuable. That's exactly the way that you'll see additional sessions delivered in the future by submitting feedback and letting us know. So my thanks very much to EPA Region 5 and Walt and the instructors as well and everyone who attended today. So with that, I'm going to sign off on the phone lines, and we're going to terminate today's online broadcast. Thanks very much, everyone.